Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club presented by Inforum, a division of the club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. We've recently launched our new In the Know campaign. Blind faith is now truly blind. It's time to participate. If you repeat the arguments of the past, you'll continue to live there. Today that stops today, the need to be in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inform. I'm Jonathan Curiel, UCLA lecturer and former San Francisco Chronicle reporter, and this evening's moderator for the event, John Perkins, How to Remake the Global Economy. John is a reformed economist and the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, The Secret History of the American Empire, and the recently released book, Hoodwinked. John is also the founder and board member of Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance. John Perkins is here to tell us why reverting to our traditional blueprints for the global economy could prove dangerous and to show us how we can transform our mutant capitalism into a system based on sustainability and justice. So let's get started. John, you're best known for Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which came out in 2004. This book has a lot of the same motifs, and in fact uses the same similar cover. Anyway, what's the need for a sequel to your book, and why did you write this book now?
Great question, Jonathan. Well, in the 5 years since Confessions came out, I've been traveling around the United States a great deal. China, Iceland, Latin America, and perhaps most importantly, my daughter gave me a 2-year-old grandson. Well, he's 2 years old. He's two now. He didn't come out that way. And when I hold this baby in my arms and look down at him, I always have to wonder, what's this world going to look like in 6 decades when he's my age? And I think it's going to be very ugly if we stay the course. But we have a great opportunity now, all of us, to move into a very new type of world. I think we need to move out of the type of capitalism that we've been in, which I call predatory capitalism, and into a new type of economy. And I see this beginning to happen. And so Hoodwinked, it comes from a deep place of passion for me, of realizing that I don't know whether I've got another 20 minutes left of life or another 20 years. I know it's not probably too much longer than that. And I know that I want to devote all of that time to making a better world for my grandson, and the realization that the only way he can have a sustainable, just, and peaceful world is if every child growing up in Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, the whole world has that same hope, that same expectation, and we realize it for everyone. We're such a small planet. Now, we're such a fragile species living on this tiny planet. It's really a spaceship without a shuttle, and I think we've got the wrong navigators and pilots running it, and we need to change that. So Hoodwinked for me was about how do we change that? Where do we go from here? We've created a failure. We've got to get into a system that truly works for everyone.
I should say that the subtitle of the book is An Economic Hitman Reveals Why the World Financial Markets Imploded and What We Can Do, what we need to do to remake them. Now, your previous book and other writings by you have talked about the countries, say, in Africa and other, you know, quote-unquote third world areas that this economic program has hit, as it were, right? But this book, Hoodwinked, starts off in Iceland. You know, you go there, and at one point Iceland was a kind of model of an economic upturn. Real estate prices, real estate values up, economy way up. And when you go there, it's become downsized, as it were. And you're struck by how similar Iceland's economy is to these other, you know, economies that were in the third world, as it were. So can you talk about how this meltdown really is surprising and how that relates to this book and your previous work?
Yeah, you know, In 2007, Iceland was ranked by the World Bank as the world's third wealthiest country per capita. And I was interviewed for a documentary on Iceland made by Icelandic television about that time, and was told about what Alcoa's hitmen were doing in Alcoa Aluminum and sent these people into Iceland to convince them to take out a huge loan, build a gigantic hydroelectric plant just for Alcoa, 600 megawatts. The whole country prior to that was only using 300 megawatts. And it would destroy a huge, fragile environment, and all the environmental laws were waived. And when I heard this, I said, well, Iceland will probably be the first developed country to go bankrupt. And I said this on this documentary, and it happened a couple of years later. Because, in fact, every megawatt hour that sold to Alcoa cost the country hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it's a terrible deal for Iceland, a great deal for Alcoa. And so when the movie premiered in Iceland, they invited me to come and go around the country talking. And it really struck me as how, you know, here Iceland had been hit in exactly the same way that I used to hit countries in the third world. You have a resource that corporations covet. In the case of Iceland, it was electricity, cheap electricity. In the case of many countries, it was oil. You arrange a huge loan to that country, and you strike a really good deal for multinational corporations. And then in the end, the country can't pay off its loan, like Iceland can't now. So you've got them. You know, they're part of the empire. You've got them. You can ask favors. You can ask, vote with you on the next UN vote, whatever. And so I watched this happen all over the third world during my time as an economic hitman, and here it was happening in Iceland, and now it's happening in the United States. It's very similar to what we've done with our housing loans. You know, we've convinced people to take out loans that they can't pay. Buy a $400,000 house, even though you really should only be affording a $300,000 one. But remember, that house is going to be worth $800,000 5 years from now. That's what people were told. When it doesn't happen, people can't pay their loans, and they become essentially slaves of the system. That's what I mean by a predatory form of capitalism. It's a form that benefits a few wealthy and powerful people and has made them incredibly wealthy and powerful. Just today it was announced that Wall Street's making record profits this year, and all the executives are going to get huge bonuses, while the rest of us, our houses are being foreclosed and we're unemployed.
Well, in your book, Hoodwink, you talk about how Obama's election doesn't necessarily herald a new beginning of change when it comes to the U.S. economy and business, and that you describe it as a corporatocracy, that the corporatocracy's tentacles are so settled in all aspects of the economy, but also politics and from lobbyists and so forth. Can you talk about how, as far as you're concerned, Obama's election is really a mixed bag?
Well, yes. You know, I think there's a strong symbolic thing that happened with Obama's election. We, the people, said we want change. We definitely sent the message out there, we want radical change. And we have seen in the last few years Latin America having a revolution. There is a revolution going on. 10 countries in Latin America representing more than 80% of the people there have voted in governments that are saying no more exploitation by foreign corporations. You know, our resources are going to be used to help our people. We'll strike deals with foreign companies because you've got the technology, but we want our resources to help our people. 10 countries in Latin America. And every one of those 10 countries during most of my lifetime was ruled by dictators. Every one of them. Brutal dictators, usually with the help of the CIA. That all changed in the last few years. And then that revolution really kind of moved north. And we went from a very conservative Republican, a white Republican oil man, to a very liberal African-American from the Midwest. A huge symbolic change. But in the process, Obama took a lot of money from Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street firms and from Monsanto. And no surprise that Goldman Sachs now is running the financial sector and Monsanto is running the agricultural sector. And that's the way the system works. It's a sick, terrible system. And I think the most important thing that comes out of this, as far as I'm concerned, is what I've been saying all along, is that it has to be we the people. We can't just vote in an Obama or anybody and then sit back and watch Monday Night Football or American Idol or whatever we're watching. We've got to make it happen. We the people have to do it, and it's always been that way. We're back to that again, and I think that the mixed signal is we sent a strong message. We want serious change. And Then we sat back. We're sitting back today. We've got to take over. You know, I think it's fair to say that our country has been stolen. The world's been stolen. And we want to get it back. And we're going to get it back.
Well, let's go back a little bit, because let's talk about your time in the 1970s, where you were, even though you didn't realize it at the time, an economic hitman. I think there are people listening and here in the audience who may not necessarily know what that actually entails. And can you briefly summarize what your job was as a quote-unquote economic hitman in Indonesia and other places where you represent this kind of government-corporate tandem designed to draw in resources and then dependency in a way?
Try as hard as I do, I can't get away from it, can I? Right. Well, you know, we worked many ways, and I sort of alluded to this earlier. Perhaps the most common thing that we economic hitmen do is to identify a country, usually a third world country, that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters, but the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, highways, industrial parks, things that benefit a few wealthy people but don't help the majority of the people. They mainly benefit our corporations. The majority of the people don't have enough money to buy electricity. They can't drive cars on the highways. They don't get jobs in industrial parks. But they're left holding this huge debt that they can't possibly repay. And so at some point we go back to the country and say, you can't repay your debt. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies and don't have any environmental restrictions on what they can do. Let them destroy the rainforests or the deserts or whatever. Or vote with us on the next critical United Nations vote, or let us build a military base on your lands. And in that way, we've created this empire. When we fail, and I talk in my books, I talk in Hoodwink about how I failed with Jaime Roldós, the president of Ecuador, Omar Torrijos of Panama, who in fact came up with the name Hoodwinked for the book. He's dead now, but I failed. I couldn't bring these men around. They wouldn't be corrupted. And so when that happens, the jackals go in and either overthrow the governments or assassinate the leaders. Both Roldós and Torrijos were assassinated by CIA-sponsored jackals because they wouldn't succumb to us, to us economic hitmen. And I think it's fair to say, Jonathan, that in that way, we've created the world's first truly global empire, first empire to be created without a military primarily. And although if the jackals also fail, which is what happened in Iraq, the military as a last resort does go in. We've seen that happen too. And I think we as Americans have to be deeply concerned, because empires in the past have always been built by sending young men off to war, military. And there was always a justification, spreading Christianity or democracy or civilization. And most people applauded the fact that Spain was doing it, or Rome was doing it, or England was doing it, or whoever. But this time, we've created an empire that's secret. Most of us don't realize that this has been going on. And yet we claim to be a democracy. And a democracy is built on the premise that you have an informed electorate. So if we're not informed about this most basic premise of our foreign policy, then it's very hard to figure out how we can really be a democracy. It's why I write these books, you know, for my grandson, and because I think we have to be informed. If we want to be a democracy, we've got to understand that this is going on, and that in this process, we've created a world system that's a failure.
We should note that in the 70s, when you were an economic hitman, you were sworn to secrecy, and you were riddled with guilt. You write about this in your books and in Hoodwinked as well. And it was after 9/11, really, that crystallized this kind of internal combustion, let's call it combustion, guilt, what have you, and prompted you to reveal these secrets in your books. But here's an example of how the revealing in itself has helped solve some things, maybe. Recently, Ecuador's Rafael Correa has said, you know what, our country is signing off on all the loans we took from the IMF and these other organizations when we were vulnerable. And in fact, he did that after reading Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Now, I don't know if there's a direct correlation there, whether you are responsible for this.
Absolutely.
Okay.
he wrote a great endorsement for my last book also. Yeah.
but talk about that, how the effect that your books are actually having on certain levels of politics, economics, what have you.
Well, Correa has said that the book had a big influence on him. But let's face it, Rafael Correa has a PhD in economics from the University of Illinois. He's president of Ecuador, speaks four languages. He's a very educated man. He didn't really need my book, you know. He understands what's going on in the world. And I think this is very significant because he has said Ecuador is not going to pay off these debts. We don't owe it. He said, you know, those debts were signed off by a military dictatorship in this country. And that military dictatorship was put into place by the CIA. And then you economic hitmen came down and got the military dictatorship to sign off on these loans. He said, I think the military dictatorship owes the money. Of course, they're all living in Miami or Switzerland today. And he says, and then I think maybe the World Bank owes some of the money, and certainly the CIA owes some of the money, and you, John Perkins, owe some of the money. But the Ecuadorian people do not owe any of the money. We didn't sign off on the loans, and we didn't get any benefits, and we're not paying. And he also says, I'm a capitalist. I believe in capitalism, but I believe that capitalism ought to be able to help my country use its own resources, its oil and other resources, to pull its own people up by their bootstraps. There's no reason why capitalism can't help the poorest of the poor. There's no reason why capitalism has to be part of an imperialistic system. There's no correlation there. And, you know, how do people object to that? You can't, you know, it's pretty hard for the politicians, the corporatocracy, the head of corporations in this country to say, Rafael Correa, you're a communist, you're a Marxist. He has a PhD in economics from the University of Illinois. He's an avowed capitalist. I think it's a very powerful thing that's going on in Ecuador. And just in the last couple of years, he's pushed through a new constitution that was recently voted on by about 80% of the population, the first constitution in the history of the world that gives inalienable rights to nature. Incredible, an incredible move. Amazing man. And now he's working to create a new currency for his country that's based on real value, including, you know, the value of housewives taking care of children. What's the value of that? He's working on creating a new currency. Pachamama Alliance, which I'm on the board of, is a San Francisco-based organization. I know there's several people in the audience who are connected with Pachamama, is very much involved, was involved in the Constitution, and also involved in this new currency thing. So some fascinating things are going on right now in Ecuador and throughout Latin America.
Now we should note that after the success of the Confessions of an Economic Hitman, your books are bestsellers, instant bestsellers. I noticed that this week, the same week that Sarah Palin has an instant bestseller, you also have an instant bestseller, and you're in her ranks, as it were.
She and I are really very good friends, yes.
But I was going to say, similar to Sarah Palin, you have your critics. Now,
probably different ones, though.
a few. I mean, it's almost the antithesis of the type of critic she has. But one of your critics, you'll recognize his name maybe, is Sebastian Mallaby, Washington Post columnist. You could argue that he's a conservative columnist, but
wouldn't take much of an argument to.
Okay. But he's described you, I believe, as a conspiracy theorist. And when he says that, he's talking about your emphasis on the corporatocracy, and he's essentially saying that, well, there is no grand scheme among corporations, government, to kind of rule the world as you suggest. And I know the National Security Agency has also come out with a kind of warning. Essentially, they're saying, warning, do not read John Perkins. but of course, all these warnings, you know, cause more people to read you and make you more successful. But can you talk about the resistance you've met in any way and how what you do to kind of meet that resistance?
Yeah, you know, I guess the first step would be to go back a bit and say that after I stopped being an economic hitman, I started to write confessions several times, and I contacted other economic hitmen and jackals to get their stories, and I received anonymous phone calls, threats, serious threats. My daughter was born in 82. This was during that time. And there was, and at the same time, I was offered a huge bribe, well, $500,000 by Stone & Webster, a big engineering firm in Boston. The chairman of the board took me out to dinner. He said, look, you know, he said, you've got a great resume. I did. I was chief economist of a major consulting firm. I had a staff of 40, 50 people. And he said, we want to use your resume, and you won't have to do any work, but I'd like to give you a consultant's retainer of $500,000. Just don't write the book. I took it because the alternative to me was my daughter's life, possibly. And I have to say, I assuaged my guilt by putting a lot of that money toward nonprofit work. You could look up dreamchange.org or pachamama.org. They grew out of that work eventually. So I didn't use it frivolously. It did assuage my guilt that I spent a lot of time with some of the people I'd screwed in the past trying to help them, still do. And but I didn't write the book. And then after 9/11, I was in the Amazon with some of these people on 9/11, went up to Ground Zero. And as I'm standing there looking down into that still smoldering pit, I knew I had to write the book. I knew people had to understand what we do in this country sometimes, what I'd done. And this time I decided I wouldn't tell anybody. I'd had five other books published on indigenous people, not on the subject at all. I didn't, you know, do that. But I knew the route. You submit a proposal to publishers. I didn't do any of that. I wrote the whole book secretly. Didn't even tell my wife and daughter what I was writing about. Put it in the hands of my very good agent, and he distributed it to publishing houses. At that point, it became my best insurance policy. And, you know, even like tonight, if one of you comes up and shoots me as I'm signing books out there, Random House will probably be very happy. Hoodwinked will beat out Sarah Palin if you do that. So seriously, it became an insurance policy. And beyond that, I have had resistance. Bechtel Corporation over across the pond here at one point sent us some very nasty letters and setting us up for a lawsuit. The Summer Institute of Linguistics, which is a missionary group I mentioned, did something similar. But we sent them all my backup information, the files I had. I have great backup information. And they went away because they knew they'd lose the case and it gave me a lot of publicity in the process. So the way I deal with criticism and so on, a lot of it I just let it go. But if it's serious, like something like that, I will send proof and evidence of what I've got backing this information up because it's all very solid.
Well, before the book, the Confessions of an Economic Hitman came out, I mean, that term was not in use at all. Now, I was in a bookstore in Los Angeles earlier today, and the person by the counter said, John Perkins, who is he, sees the cover of your book, which has you in sunglasses, right, and in a sort of James Bond-like pose, yeah, and says, oh, the Economic Hitman. Oh, yeah, of course, we know his work. But he put it almost in the present tense, like as if you still were an economic hitman. And I know that's not the case, but there are still economic hitmen out there, James Bond-like figures who are in this world of economics, violence, and also sex, by the way. I mean, this you've written about not only in your first book, but also Hoodwink. You describe a woman named Claudia. Is that correct?
Claudine,
excuse me. And so... So like the James Bond figures, you know, your old life did involve a lot of traveling, parading, and a lot of other things we don't have to talk about now.
Thank you.
But can you talk about, I mean, economic hitmen and for that matter women, if there are any right now, who are doing, you know, what you used to do?
Yeah, and quite a few of them I've met since then, and jackals also. I know several jackals who are currently in Afghanistan and or Iraq who've contacted me. And there have been a number of other books that have come out. Barrett Kohler from this city here, who put out Confessions originally, has a book called A Game as Old as Empire that tells the stories of some of the others. And so... there's still a lot of economic hitmen out there. In fact, I think in any country that has resources or markets that we covet, our corporations covet, they're there. And I think, you know, you know, I do want to move on. I don't know what your intent here. We hadn't talked about this, Jonathan, beforehand, but to talk about some of the solutions to all of this, too. And I think that one of the things that we're seeing is more and more people coming out and admitting to things like this. So the whole idea of confessing, the whole idea that we need to move beyond this into something else, I think has become quite accepted. I spoke at both the United Nations last week and also at a conference where there were 2,400 MBA students. It was in Cornell this year. It moves around the country at different places every year. Last year was at Wharton. This year was interesting to me that the CEO of General Electric, Jeff Immelt, was also a speaker there. So it was kind of interesting. We had the CEO of General Electric, sort of sharing the podium with the former economic hitman, which I took a certain perverse delight in. You know, that was kind of fun. Because I criticized his predecessor, Jack Welch, quite seriously in this book. I think Jack Welch is a robber baron. And I like to say that in MBA programs, because MBA students are often, he's held up as kind of an icon, a guy who made his company lean and mean. He certainly made it mean. He fired a quarter of GE's employees and gave himself huge raises and bonuses at the same time and refused to clean up all the pollution in the Hudson River that his company has caused and caused a lot of deaths as a result. Lean and mean. It was certainly mean.
Well, let's talk about some of the solutions. And as I said earlier, the subtitle is, one of the parts of the subtitle is what we need to do to remake the financial markets. Now, in Hoodwinked, you talk about what consumers can do, but you also, and I think this is a good point you're making, you also talk about the guilt, in a sense, that people have and the contradictions they feel. And you mentioned your own daughter talking about a $200 crib she can buy that's apparently made in China, or a $600 crib that uses sustainable wood and other things.
Yeah.
That's a $400 difference. And she asked you, Dad, what do I do?
Well, she did, and then she told me what she was going to do. But my daughter, Jessica, works for nonprofits, she always says. She doesn't make a lot of money, and she counts pennies. So this was not a light decision for her. And she called me, and she, before her baby was born, Grant, my grandson, and said, yeah, I found a $200 crib that's made in China, probably sweatshops, or a $600 one that's made in Canada with certified plantation trees. You know, which one do you think I should buy? And before I answered, she said, of course, I'm going to buy the $600 one because it's an investment in my son's future. I would pay $400 for a car seat to save his life. I would pay $400 for a better daycare where I knew he was going to get good, be watched carefully and taken care of. So I'm certainly willing to pay $400 not to have slaves making his crib who are future terrorists and starving people in the world. I want to create a better world for him. And I think that's a very, very important way for all of us to look at this world that we're in now, that we've got to make these investments. We have to, sometimes it costs a little bit more to make these investments, but they are investments. And all of this is an investment in the future. The time we put into sitting here together and discussing these things, the time we put into taking action to moving into this new economy is probably the most important investment perhaps humanity has ever made. I think we're at this time in history that's truly revolutionary and truly, truly significant. You know, Jonathan, I'm struck by the fact that for the first time in human history, every one of us, every human being on this planet, every life form is faced by the same crises. You've always had earthquakes here, hurricanes in Florida, tsunamis in Indonesia. They don't really impact each other that much. But today, every one of us is impacted by the crises of global warming and overpopulation, resources diminishing at accelerating rates, prices of food, fuel, and other essentials increasing at accelerating rates, violence that's due to desperation and starvation. We're all confronting these things. And for the first time in human history, in just the last few years, we've all started communicating with each other. We're all talking by cell phone and the internet. Just a few years ago, you could go deep into the Amazon, high into the Himalayas. They had no hope of ever having a telephone because you couldn't put wires in those places. But then suddenly, Everybody today has cell phones. I was just deep in the Amazon and high in the Himalayas within the last few years. They've got cell phones, internet. We're all talking. This is revolutionary. We're all facing the same crises, and we're all talking about it. And so we really are one community, even though to a certain degree we haven't really come to grips with that yet. But it's truly the case. We're terribly interrelated. And that's why I say, you know, and Jessica recognizes that if people in China are in sweatshops making cribs for her child, and she's buying them and supporting that, she's supporting a very dangerous future. On the other hand, if she supports people that are paid well in trees on plantations, she's creating a better future.
Right. So faced with these choices, I mean, can you give us an example of a choice that you've faced recently that you realized is related to, you know, the philosophy of your books? You know, maybe it's not quite the $200 versus $600 crib, but is there something that you're even realizing, even at this stage in your life? Oh, wow, I didn't realize that also relates to, you know, what I've written about. There may not be. I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, I have to say, I'm always at a little bit of a struggle to have Penguin and Random House publish my books because they're part of the corporatocracy. And Barrett Kohler here in San Francisco published Confessions first, and I was very happy about that, but they had a very, very difficult time distributing it. One of the first places I spoke was up in Portland at Powell's. We must have had 500 people there that night. The store was just overwhelmed, and they only had 20 books. And the bookstore was very upset because they couldn't get more books. And at one point, we almost had a riot. And one guy stands up and he says, "Have you considered that your publisher may be owned by the CIA?" And eventually, Barrett Kohler sold the paperback rights to Penguin and made a lot of money doing that, which enabled Barrett Kohler to move ahead and do wonderful things. And they're a great publisher, and I have great admiration for them. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, to me, the most important thing is to get this message out as fast as I can and to as many people as I can. But it is a dilemma. Do you go with companies that are part of the corporatocracy? I asked them to use soy-based inks and use recycled paper as much as they could, and they have. They've made some compromises. But things like that are always a bit of a compromise. And I think what we have to do is constantly push all of these companies. So when I'm on book tours with them, I ask them to get me cars that are hybrids and hotels that are that have a reputation, that are companies that are trying hard. I think what's really important is that we all buy from companies that have changed this, that instead of this goal of maximizing profits regardless of the social and environmental costs, which is the goal that's really driven the corporatocracy. This whole mutant form of capitalism comes from the Milton Friedman School of Economics, which was embraced by Reagan and has been by every president since. And it basically has three tenets. One is that the sole responsibility of business is to make profits, regardless of the social and environmental cost. Two, there should be no rules or regulations on business because that interferes with making profits. And three, business should own everything. Privatize the army, which we're doing. Privatize jails, privatize everything. And I think those three things, we must turn around, and one of the most important ones is for all of us only to buy from businesses that are committed, go ahead, make profits, but only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. We've got to change that goal, and that's not a radical thought.
Yeah, and one of the things your book does, and you being a trained economist, this helps, is that it brings before maybe lay people economic terms they may not have thought about. So, for example, in Hoodwinked, you talk about the long-standing debate between John Keynes and Milton Friedman and how their disciples have continued this debate and that Friedman essentially won through Ronald Reagan, but also, surprisingly, I hadn't thought about this, but it was a really good thing you reminded us, through Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. And that really, George Bush was called himself a compassionate conservative. In some sense, that label could apply to Bill Clinton. And in fact, you criticized Clinton his during his presidency, his Africa overtures, mm-hmm. his economic overtures. And I wonder if you could just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, Clinton had what he called the African Renaissance, which was the support of one brutal dictator after another, as long as they did favors to big American corporations. And I think we've seen this over and over in our system. You know, this embracing of Friedman economics. You know, yeah, I was brought up in the Keynesian. Even Nixon Nixon said we're all Keynesians, but that changed very quickly. And under Keynes, the belief was that corporations were there not just to make profits, but to do good things and to serve the people. And this goes back, you know, in the United States. For the first 100 years of this country, no corporation could get a charter unless it could prove that it served the public interest. And charters only ran on average for 10 years. And then you had to go back and prove you'd served the public interest to get another charter. And that all changed in the late 1800s when the Supreme Court decided that corporations had all the legal rights of individuals and without any of the responsibilities. And since then, we've kind of been going downhill a lot with a few times that we've gone up. But then Keynes came into the picture, and he said, well, government has to play an important role here. There is a very important role for government, and it's part of it is to rein in businesses and make them compassionate. And then Milton Friedman's Chicago School said, no, there should be no compassion. Business is not about compassion. Its only responsibility is making profits. That's it. And Reagan embraced that big time. And every president has since, including Clinton, it appears in a way that Obama's embracing that today, or at least his advisors are. I think it's really, really time we understood that that is a sick philosophy. And it's creating a very, very dangerous world. And it's not capitalism. It's a mutant viral form of capitalism. It's this predatory capitalism that is extremely narrow-minded and I think contrary to human nature.
So do you count yourself then as an Obama critic?
You know, I like Obama and I like his eloquence and I like a lot of what he says and what he does, and I think what we must understand is that that presidents and countries are no longer very powerful. We're at a time in history that's like when cities became nation states, except today the nations are losing their relevance. So it used to be that you had a planet with roughly 200 countries, of which a few had a lot of power, United States being the most recent, Soviet Union before that. But now I think we look at this globe with 200 countries and huge clouds drifting around it. The big corporations, and they know no national borders. They don't listen to any specific sets of laws. They call the shots, and they're calling the shots in our Congress, and they have huge armies of lobbyists. They finance campaigns. They own the mainstream press, and Obama walks into a situation where that's very, very prevalent, and he happened to have taken a lot of money from big corporations, which he owes a lot of debts to now. So it comes back to us. We the people. And, you know, I'm often think about how slavery didn't end in this country because Abraham Lincoln found himself in the White House. Abraham Lincoln got in the White House because we wanted to end slavery. And women didn't get the right to vote here because Woodrow Wilson was pro-suffrage. He wasn't. Women got the right to vote because once he was, they'd been demonstrating for it for a long time, but once he was elected president, Wilson went around the country trying to convince this nation to get involved in World War I to defend democracy in Europe. Women followed him everywhere he went, and they chanted, and they carried placards, and they shouted, and they said, why should we send our men off to Europe to defend democracy there when half of us in the United States, we women, can't vote? We want a democracy here first. And Wilson got it. You know, we didn't get out of Vietnam because Nixon was anti-war. He wasn't. We were losing pretty badly, and we, the people, demanded it. We must demand at this point. We've got to put the pressure on Obama. Franklin Roosevelt, you know, this famous saying after he had a meeting with union leaders in the 30s, as he left them at the White House door, he said, I think you understand that I'm with you. I agree with you. Now you've got to go out and force me to do the right thing. We have to force Obama. We have to force whoever's in the White House. We have to force the heads of corporations to do the right thing. We've been sending this message, you and I, we've all been sending this message that we want cheap T-shirts. And if that means slaves and sweatshops in Indonesia, we'll just look the other way. And we want cheap petroleum for our car, and if that means destroying the Amazon rainforest, we'll just look the other way. Oh, and we want high rates of return on our stocks. So the corporations have gone along with this, and it's also the Milton Friedman policy, you know. So we need to turn that around, and we've got to send the message, what we want is a good world for ourselves, our children, our grandchildren, and realize that that's for every child on the world. We want homeland security, but we understand that we will never have homeland security until we know, we recognize that the homeland is our entire planet. It isn't bordered by the Rio Grande and the Canadian border. It is the entire planet. And the only way my grandson is going to have security is if every child in this planet has security. And we've got to get that. We've got to get it. And we've got to force our leaders to understand that, too. There's got to be like a change of consciousness here.
Okay, well, let's imagine that somebody forces, like Rahm Emanuel, forces your book on President Obama's desk. And Obama reads your book and realizes, like he's read other books, you know, he is a voracious reader, realizes, wait a minute, what I've been doing is maybe not good enough. Hmm. Are you hoping something like that happens, you know, that scenario?
Sure, that'd be wonderful to see that happen. But I still think that we have to keep coming back to the reality that we've got to make it happen. We've got to create a new economy. You know, we've got to stop making missiles and instead make equipment that cleans up the polluted lakes of Nicaragua and the polluted forests and the polluted lands all over the world. Let's use a percentage of our national budget, of our military budget, to pay the same companies that are currently making missiles or GMOs to instead make equipment that'll not only produce sustainable electricity and energy, but also will clean up the terrible pollution in the world. And let's pay companies like Monsanto and Dole to create new ways for the starving people of Africa to feed themselves and to distribute food and store it. You know, I think we're at a stage where we need to really create an economy that's not based on the military or trinkets. Let's create an economy that makes things that people all over this planet really need, and it'll make it a better planet for all of us and our children. I really think we can do that, and I think it's exciting. I think it's an amazing time to be a human being here. And for us in the United States, which still is the leader country, people are watching us, for us to really take the initiative and go out there and get our country back, get the world back.
To our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, we're going to be taking your questions soon, so you can start lining up at the mic now, if you'd like. The mic is to your left. One final question, then, before we begin taking questions from the audience. I know you were here a year ago or so, and at that point, I kind of jokingly asked about the movie version of your life and your books, and I think you joked that Harrison Ford was actually interested in it. That was a year ago. What's any updates on the cinematic versions of all your books and your life?
Harrison Ford and this company that he apparently was tied into paid a lot of money to my publishing companies and some to me to have the rights to, and they held those rights for 5 years. And then Harrison got distracted by Indiana Jones. That's the way I've heard it. Anyway. And just November 1st, just a few weeks ago, a couple of weeks ago, I got the rights back, which I'm very, very grateful for, because although they were paying money all along, the meter was running, I think they sent script writers down to Panama. I think they spent close to $1 million on this thing and then lost the rights. I've got them back. So we're negotiating with some other film companies, if any of you would like the rights. And incidentally, I'm not interested in getting any more money for these rights. I just want to see the film made, you know. And the film that they had written, I mean, it's crazy because Harrison Ford was playing a guy who was 33 years old. So the makeup can do so much, but they rewrote my life for this movie. I mean, they made it about a guy who was in his late 60s instead of a guy who was in his 30s, which totally changed everything. So I was really, really glad that I got back the rights. I'd like to see the movie made, but be a little bit more truthful.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's In Forum, and tonight we're hosting John Perkins, How to Remake the Global Economy. I'm Jonathan Curiel, UCLA lecturer and journalist and moderator for the evening, and I'm in discussion with John, who is the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman and the just-released Hoodwinked. Now let's go to the audience for questions. First question, please.
Thank you, John. I love your work, and you've been very kind to my father, Senator Mike Gravel. And you talk about women's right to vote and civil rights, and it did come from the people. It didn't come from the government. And the whole issue of make them do it. We don't really have a mechanism for voting on the budget. And I think we, the people, are smart enough to vote on the budget. I don't know if you've seen Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's work on the, where he does the federal budget in Oreo cookies. Have you seen that one? The stack of Oreo cookies for the Pentagon is gigantic. It's like this. And then the stack for education, like this, green energy, that, healthcare, that. I think we, the American people, could understand. You take some Oreos off of this Pentagon stack if you want to cut the budget, and you redistribute that to education, green energy jobs, the things that we need. It just seems to me that we, the people, can make those decisions, and the initiative process, although it's very flawed in California because it's a money game still in California, but Oregon's got better initiative process. It seems like democracy 2.0, we're ready for it. We the people make better decisions on going to war or not going to war. We the people make better decisions on single payer. What are your thoughts regarding bringing the people in as the fourth check in our system of checks and balances?
Well, I totally agree. I'd love to see it happen. The question is, how do we make it happen? And you and your family and Mike Gravel have been involved in this for a long time, and you've seen all the difficulties of really moving forward with things. And my hat's off to you and your dad, incidentally. And But I think the time is right now. I think there is a revolutionary spirit around the world, and it's happening. And so I think you probably know better than I do how to do that. My background's in corporations, and I'm not much at politics. I totally agree with you. In theory, we need to have a much stronger voice. There's no question about it. How do we get there? I can't really answer that question. I think that's where your passion is. And one of the things I like to say to people is, what do we each do? What do you do? And I think one of the most important things is that we all must follow our passions. Each of you has passion. I don't know what your passion is. I know what your passion is. And my passion is, I have a passion for writing, and I hope I have some talent in it. You have a passion in politics. You have a lot of talent in it. Whatever your passion is and your talent is, follow it and join organizations, that are in line with that passion. And that will take us down the road. We must all follow our passions. And the other night, I walked by a television set. Monday Night Football was on. And I see all these people standing up and shouting and cheering, and I'm thinking, there's passion. What if they were directing their passions to bringing the people in to write the budget? Let's channel those passions. There's so much passion. Let's use it to make this a better world. And I really appreciate you saying that. And my politics is not my field. It's yours. You make it happen. And call on me to help you in any way I can. Thanks. And all of us here. Thanks.
Next question, yeah.
Thank you. Joseph Malky with 7starevents.com. Thank you so much for what you're doing. My question to you is, if you could invert everything that you have learned in terms of the skill set for destabilizing governments to the advantage of a particular nation state or multinational corporation, and turn that training into its opposite, which would be to teach a generation of MBA students how to do sustainable development, what sort of tips, procedures, ideas, creative thoughts would you have around creating a cabal of good guys?
Well, I think that's basically what I'm trying to do here. And when I talk to MBA students, I think one of the most important things is to look at our self-interest. Because basically when I would go into corrupt government officials, I was trying to appeal to their self-interest. You and your family and your friends are going to make a lot of money if you accept these loans from the World Bank and hire our companies. The country may not do so well, but you're going to do really well. And you appeal to that self-interest. And what I'm trying to do now is appeal to all of our self-interest that the only way for us to have a world that any of us would want to experience or have our children or grandchildren experience is that we've got to change it, and that's our self-interest. So how do we promote that self-interest? How do we truly get people to understand that we're on a course of terrible destruction, that we are in a spaceship, and the navigators and pilots are incompetent, and they're heading us in the wrong direction, and there's nothing to take us off. There's no shuttle. We've got to do it. We've got to mutiny. We've got to take the spaceship over again. And it's in our self-interest. And so I think that's the way. We have to promote it as being part of our self-interest. And also to realize that it's totally possible. People get overwhelmed by the problem sometimes. And I so often think of George and Martha Washington and Tom Paine and Jefferson. Look what they were up against. The most powerful empire in the history of the world. And they all put their necks in nooses. All of those people that we now look back at as the founding fathers were traitors. Washington was an officer in the British Army. He was a terrorist. He was a traitor. He was also the wealthiest man in the colonies, and he put everything at stake. If he'd lost the revolution, he and his wife would have hung. And so would all the others. And I think we need to remember that. And you know what? This is fun. Making a better world, what more would you want to do with your life? You know, I mean, that's fun. When I look back, I hated being an economic hitman. I lived on Valium and alcohol. I traveled first class, and as you said, I hung out with some gorgeous women and dined with presidents and had what sounded like a great life, but I was miserable. And I went through a terrible divorce, and I went to a lot of therapy, and I drank a lot and took a lot of pills, and now I'm happy. I'm not doing any of that, but we're changing the world. This is fun. Thanks.
I'm John Carpenter, and I appreciate what you've done so far, but I seem to be concerned quite a bit about what's going on in the Middle East. Like, for instance, and you know, I'm just wondering what in heaven's name is Halliburton doing to Iraq? I wonder what Iraq's future is going to be like with Halliburton. That's one thing. The other thing is that the thing that really is screwing up the Palestinian-Israeli peace process is water. There's a very serious water problem in Israel-Palestine. Israel controls the water on a per capita basis. A Palestinian is allotted one quarter of the water of that of the Israeli. So your comments on all that?
Well, I don't have much more. There wasn't a question there, I don't think.
I was just wondering what the. Have you done anything on Middle East?
I write a lot about it, especially in Secret History of the American Empire and also in Hoodwinked. And yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's a huge concern. We must solve that problem in the Middle East. I do take hope from the fact that what's happened in Latin America, this revolution we've seen there, very diverse factions. People that have been at war for 500 years, the indigenous people and the military people, suddenly came together in the last few years and said it's to our self-interest to work together to rein in these corporations. And so you have very diverse groups. And I've been in meetings in New York, board meetings and meetings at artistic institutions where there are Palestinians and Israelis or Jewish people and Islamic people sitting in the same room getting along beautifully. And Sunnis and Shiites getting along beautifully. It can happen. But part of what's going on in the Middle East is we're constantly trying to divide and create problems. Because if you can divide people, you can steal their resources. And so we really need to push for that. And I think the lesson of Latin America is that those kinds of people can come together. I was also recently lecturing at the university two weeks ago, Howard University, which is primarily African and African-American, their law school. And I spent a lot of time talking with the African students there. And it was, what's fascinating is the wealthiest continent in the world is Africa. Think about that. Poorest people in the world, wealthiest continent. That's more resources there than anywhere else. But we've divided and conquered them that way. And now it's for them to come together. People in the Middle East must do that too, to recognize that they have a common goal. They have incredible resources. So to come together. Thanks. We all have to come together. It's something we all must do in this country too, alliances, coming together, realizing that we've got to mutiny, we've got to take back our country and the world.
Next question, please.
Hi, my name's David Thompson. I was just curious if you had heard of B corporations, B as in boy, and if you'd had any thoughts or...
Great idea, yeah. These are corporations that are kind of a hybrid between nonprofits and for-profits. State of Vermont, which is where I was supposed to be born, but my mother got across the river and had me born in New Hampshire instead for some reason anyway. They're doing a great job with B corporations, and so are a number of other states. This idea that you can have this hybrid. And in fact, I'm very involved in a project in Panama that's doing that, that's bringing private capital and connecting that private sector with the for-profit sector with the not-for-profit sector in order to purchase huge amounts of rainforest and save them and rehabilitate them. Colin Wheel is here, who is one of the investors and one of the very strong people behind that program. B corporations in that same category. I love the idea. I'd like to see a lot more of it happen. Thanks.
Next question, please.
Hello, Mr. Perkins. Thank you so much. I thank you for sharing your passion with us. I wonder if you would have any advice for young people who may have passions of their own and exquisite educations, perhaps, to go along with it, but very little in the way of opportunity. I mean, in some ways, we have been hoodwinked of our own futures in this country. Our educational systems have been corporatized, and many of us are out of jobs and struggling to pay rent. It's difficult to reshape the world when we can't work the day-to-day processes.
Thank you. Yes, I feel for you. It's a tough time to be going through getting into the workforce and finding employment and jobs. And one of the things I've been talking about as I've gone around to business schools is that if you can't find a job, this is the time to create one. Entrepreneurship. I mean, we need it. Go out there and follow whatever your passion is. Follow your passion. But again, you know, we need people coming up with systems for cleaning up the terribly polluted lands. Nicaragua, I was just there trying to help Campesino farmers get involved in organic farming. Whole Foods was going to buy the produce. And the land's been destroyed by Chiquita and Dole and Kraft and Cargill. But there's machines that can clean it up. Let's form businesses to do that. Form businesses to help starving people in Africa feed themselves. Form businesses to get sustainable energy. There's so much that we can do. I was just recently, right here in San Francisco at the Green Festival this past weekend. And my God, you know, you go out there in this amazing marketplace that's full of people that are coming up with brilliant ideas, entrepreneurs that are doing amazing things. So I would really encourage you, if you can't find a job out there, create one. Create a business. This is a time for innovation, for entrepreneurship, and that's a lot of fun too. So, and I know I don't mean to be frivolous. There's a lot of risk and a lot of fear involved in doing that. Overcome your fear and do it.
We have about 5 minutes left, so let's.
Hi, my name is Hannah De Los Santos. My question is more about the international financial crisis and accountability and what we've learned. I wanted to see if you had comments about, I guess there was a special report that came out, the audit from the special investigator general, Borofsky, about AIG, and is there going to be a Pecora-like commission? It doesn't seem like anybody's gotten in trouble for, you know, having the economy be in such a tailspin for the last year, certainly, and
yeah,
in fact, people have benefited from it greatly, it seems.
Yeah, there's been it's a travesty. It's criminal what's been going on, and the way that the people that got us into trouble have been rewarded and are now running the organizations to get us out of trouble, including Geithner and Summers and the people that Obama's hired. Unfortunately, he's hired the same people that got us into the problem to try to get us out. It doesn't usually work. You know, I think you need to throw the jerks out and get new ones. But from my perspective, my main focus is getting at the cancer beneath the system. We got to do all that. I totally agree with you. Somebody's got to do it. And I don't, you know, it's your passion. launch a campaign, you know, go after these guys, you know, and go after Obama, make him do it, you know, make local citizens do it. Do it. This is your passion. You have a talent for it. You love doing it. You have a great time. Do it. And for me, it's also about going, you know, deep down into the system, the cancer, and that's this mutant form of capitalism, this idea that the only goal of business is to make profits and privatize everything and no regulations. We've got to turn that around, and that's where I focus more, but I'd really like to see you focusing on getting those jerks out of there and, you know, maybe punishing the ones that cause so many of the problems. A few have been. We've got a few in jail now, but more should probably be there. Thanks.
Hi, John. It's good seeing you again. We appreciate very much what you're doing, and we feel like you are a voice in the wilderness, and you are doing your part. But how in the world can we get our voice above money and lobbyists in Washington?
Well, what is your voice? You know, that's the first question. Do you sing? Do you write? Do you dance? Do you juggle? What do you do? And so there's no general answer to that question, I don't think. But do it, whatever your voice is, you know. If you juggle four balls, learn to do five. If you sing, sing louder. And we've just got to do it. We've got to force it. I wrote five books on shamanism and indigenous people, and they were popular in a small group of people. And then I wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman that was rejected by 29 publishers, before Barrett Kohler finally published it, and I think they published it because they were on the brink of bankruptcy. And then it spent 70 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. And it's shocking, but I think we just keep going. You know, you got to do it. You got to push. And I was just in Panama a few weeks ago, or a month ago, I guess, and there's this cathedral that was started to be built in 1672, and it took, about 100 years. And you see these cathedrals in Europe that took 400 years. And you think about that person that laid the first foundation stone. No idea what was going to happen after that. Is anybody going to lay another stone? But that mason had faith. That if he or she laid that stone, something would happen. And I think we're at that stage now where we've got to lay these stones. You lay your stone, I'll lay my stone. You know, I'm often struck by how lucky we are that George Washington didn't try to write pamphlets. Tom Paine didn't try to lead armies. Each of them followed their own passion and talent, and Martha Washington organized women to make clothes for the men at the forefront, but they all used their individual passions and talents headed for the same destination, and they got there. And we need to do that now, so whatever your passion, your talent is, follow it, use it, go for it with all the gusto you've possibly got. You know, you want to be burned out at the end. And your passion, and your passion, and all of our passions, and we'll all be Paines and Washingtons, and move. But let's all move in the same direction of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. Let's all move in the direction of creating a world for my grandson. Thanks. And we will get there. We will get there.
Yeah. Next question, please.
Hey, John. Enjoy your work. It seems like you're driven to reconcile a lot of misdeeds from your previous life. And how are you balancing that after writing this book with your public life that you've now embraced? How are you taking that balance between your personal life and kind of reconciling those misdeeds with the much larger message that you're trying to spend?
I don't try to reconcile it. I did what I did in the past. Incidentally, nothing I did was illegal. And many people wouldn't even consider it immoral. Certainly Milton Friedman would love what I did. And I don't try to reconcile it. And I'm not looking for forgiveness in any way. I did what I did, and I have to live with it. What I want to do now is make a better world. I want to focus on that. I'm not going to beat myself over the head. I've confessed. And people can accept that or not. But now the important thing is to move beyond this, to use what I've learned in that process and move beyond and devote myself. This is what I feel, devote myself to creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. A journalist asked my daughter one time, you know, like, so what do you think about all this stuff your dad did in the past and now he's doing what he's doing now? And she said, well, she said, I know he has to live with himself, But I'm really glad he did that, because now he can understand the system better and go out and try to make a better world for me and my son. And I feel that way. And, you know, I did what I did, and I'm not proud of it. But I want to use everything I learned from that to try to do something different now. Thanks.
Yeah, next question. Yeah.
Good evening. I came here this evening because I heard some of your ideas before, and I really love the idea of shifting what the entrenched corporations do. Instead of building military weapons, build machines that help clean up the earth, et cetera. I devote all of my time, all of my waking hours right now to independent solar energy. I've been doing that for a while now.
Great.
And yeah, I'm small time, and I'm looking.
So
at
was
the world.
Thomas Edison once.
Yeah, yeah.
Now there's GE.
Well, exactly. But and this gets to the point of my question. What makes you think that the large corporations that are entrenched and are enjoying, you know, record profits from oil will ever step aside and let people like me or others change their business model or lose
it? Yeah, I don't think there's any guarantee. There never is a guarantee. You know, there was no guarantee that George Washington was going to win the revolution. There's a risk here, and we've got to take that risk. And I so often have people come up to me who are inventors and entrepreneurs and say, you know, I don't really dare take my idea out there because I'm afraid somebody will steal it or I'll get killed or something like that will happen. Well, gee, you know, my ancestors were farmers in New Hampshire, and they took guns, and they were hunters, and they took guns and fought in the Revolution. They went down to Concord and Lexington. They didn't know that they were going to win the war. They knew they might die. I think we're at a time like that today where there's something bigger in our lives. Take those ideas out. Take the risk. You know, really push it. I had an alternative energy company that ultimately was successful, but I went through hell to get it there. And as I look back, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And Gesundheit. And people did try to steal my ideas, but in the end, it turned out pretty good. And I think we've got to stick our necks out. You know, again, there's nothing more fun than that. And so I would once again encourage all of you, I think we're bringing this to an end now, is to really, really look into your hearts, find your passion, and look at your talents, and bring the two together, and let's all march down the road together, or let's march many different roads, many different paths, but heading for that same destination, and let's get out there and create a sustainable, just, and peaceful world, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun doing it. We're going to feel really good about ourselves as we go down those paths.
Thank you, and doesn't it feel good to be in the know? Let's give a big hand to John Perkins for his thoughts here tonight.
Thank you.
And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.